In the public presentation of accurate, objective, comprehensive news on all matters
vitally affecting the community.
The Pacifica Mission Statement.
Rethinking Heroes with Kerry Harrison.
KPFK is the first in the nation to talk to tens of thousands of veterans whose issues are our issues. Whether it's peace of mind, health care, crushing medical debt, or life after duty, we cover it all each Friday morning at 9 a.m. on Rethinking Heroes, a unique show that deals with everything, and most importantly, finds real-world solutions that not only benefit our veterans, but can shortcut obstacles for the rest of us too. Get this, in the name of our vets who are still looking out for you, Rethinking Heroes will wipe out $1 million each month in general medical debt throughout Los Angeles. Yet another reason KPFK remains unique and critical. So join me, Kerry Harrison, each and every Friday at 9 a.m. for Rethinking Heroes. That's Rethinking Heroes, Friday mornings at 9, here and only here on KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
Rethinking Heroes.
You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Democracy Now!, a holiday special.
When we die, our souls leave our bodies, take with them everything they loved in our bedrooms, the perfume bottles, the makeup, the necklaces and the pens. In Gaza, our bodies and rooms get crushed. Nothing remains for the soul. Even our souls, they get stuck under the rubble for weeks.
We'll speak with Mossab Abu Toha, an acclaimed Palestinian poet from Gaza, detained by Israeli forces a year ago as he attempted to flee Israel's bombardment. He's just published a new book of poetry, Forest of Noise. It includes one poem titled Under the Rubble, which he'll read for us. Then we speak to Namante Nankimo, an indigenous leader from the Huarani Nation in Ecuador's Amazon rainforest. She helped win passage of a referendum to keep oil in the soil in Ecuador's Yasuni Park.
Los petroleros vinieron nuestro...
The oil men came to our territory flying in helicopters, promising development. They did a lot of damage. They destroyed our water, they contaminated our land, they contaminated our people as well by disconnecting us from our knowledge and values.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday broadcast, we begin the show with the acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha from Gaza. Last year, he was detained by Israeli forces as he attempted to flee with his family from Israel's bombardment of northern Gaza. While in detention, he was stripped naked and beaten. But after public pressure, Mossab Abu Toha was released 2 days later. He was eventually able to flee Gaza with his family. Mossab Abu Toha recently published a new book of poetry, Forest of Noise. His previous award-winning book of poetry was titled Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. Mossab Abu Toha is also a columnist, a teacher, and founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza. His work has appeared in The New Yorker magazine, The New York Times, and other publications. I interviewed Mossab in our New York studio in late October. A few days before our interview, he posted a message on social media that read, quote, I write with a heavy heart that my cousin, Sama, 7 years old, has been killed in the airstrike on their house along with 18 members of her family, which is my extended family, he said. I asked Mossab to talk about Sama and the attack on their family.
Sama is one of the five children of my aunt Asma, who was also injured. The mother, I mean, in the house. Sama was staying with her parents, with her siblings, with her grandmother, who happens to be my grandmother's sister. And I used to call her grandmother because my grandmother passed away when I was very young. So my grandmother's sister, with two of her daughters and her grandchildren, and two of her daughter-in-laws and the grandchildren, are still buried under the rubble until this moment. So Sama was killed in the airstrike. And the only reason why my aunt and her other children, or even though they were wounded, the only reason why they were not killed is that they were staying close to the door. Because the bomb, when it falls, it usually hits the middle of the house. So my aunt Asma survived the airstrike with some injuries, along with her husband and other four children. And they had, by the way, they were my aunt had to walk to the Israeli soldiers who were standing just a few meters away from the bombed house. So just imagine a criminal killing you and then waiting for you until you are either dead or come to them limping. And she told me that she kissed their hands, begging them to leave them alone. And if she could take with her some wheat flour from the house that she was keeping next to her, because there is no food in Gaza. So Sama was 7 years old, and I remember something very clearly, which is that every time I visited my aunt's house, especially during the Eid, the you know, after the Ramadan and after, you know, the pilgrimage season. So we have two big Eids or feasts. So I used to visit my aunt, and her children are there. And this photo is from, I think you showed it, but this is from the Eid. This is her dress. And my aunt would bring a sheet of paper and ask her daughters, including Sama, yalla, because I'm an English language teacher. So she said, yalla, show Mus'ab. Show Mus'ab the new words that you have learned, the colors, the animals. But now, Sama, I mean, I did not have the chance to bid her farewell. This is my cousin. And I lost 31 members of my extended family, including three first cousins, two of them with their husband and children. I didn't get just the chance even to see them before they were buried. And I didn't know whether some of them had any part of their bodies intact after the airstrikes. So just imagine the magnitude of loss that I'm facing I'm just one person. Some other people lost all their families. And we know about the new term, wounded child, no surviving family. About more than 2,000 children had the same case. They were the sole survivors of their family. I mean, what future is awaiting them? No one is asking this question.
Mus'ab Abu Toha is an award-winning poet and author. He has a new book of poetry out. It's called Forest of Noise. Your descriptions now make me think of your little son. You came with your three children yesterday. Can you read the poem about your son and your daughter?
Yeah, sure. So, by the way, this poem was written after May 2021 attacks. So my son Yazan was about 5 years old. My daughter Yafa was 4 years old. And this is about them.
Now, this is very important because you just said this is written in May 2021.
Yes.
Half your poems in Forest of Noise are before last October
exactly.
7th.
Yeah.
And the other half after.
Well, I mean, this tells you and others a lot of things. So this poem could be written today. And if it was written today, there are so many things that would not be present here, because this current genocide is so different from any other wars that Israel launched against the civilian population in the Gaza Strip. My son throws a blanket over my daughter. Gaza, May 2021. At night, at home, we sit on the floor, close to each other, far from the windows and the red lights of bombs. Our backs bang on the walls whenever the house shakes. We stare at each other's faces, scared yet happy that so far our lives have been spared. The walls wake up from their fitful sleep, no arms to wipe at their blurry eyes. Flies gather around the only lit ceiling lamp for warmth in the bitter night, cold except when missiles hit and burn up houses and roads and the trees. The neighborhood next to us, where Yazan learned to ride his bike, scorched. Every time we hear a bomb falling from an F-16 or an F-35, our lives panic. Our lives freeze somewhere in between, confused where to head next. A graveyard, a hospital, a nightmare. I keep my shivering hand on my wristwatch, ready to remove the battery if needed. My four-year-old daughter Yafa, wearing a pink dress given to her by a friend, hears a bomb explode. She gasps, covers her mouth with her dress's ruffles. Yazan, her 5.5-year-old brother, grabs a blanket worn by his sleepy buddy. He lays the blanket on his sister. "You can hide now," he assures her. And I have a video of that. It's on my phone. I took a video of my son throwing a blanket. That's how I couldn't forget this moment.
Can you remind our viewers and listeners who may not have seen you on Democracy Now! First, soon after October 7th, we talked to you in Gaza. We then talked to you or spoke to others about you when you were taken by the Israeli military. Then when you were released and made it with your family to Cairo, we spoke to you.
Yeah.
We spoke to you in South Africa, and now you have come to the United States. But take us on that journey, how you got out, and remind us what happened when you were separated from your family and taken by the Israeli military.
So, Amy, that interview that you did with me, it was October 12th. I can't forget the date because that was the last day I was in my house. I just finished my interview with you on October 12th. I think it was 3 p.m., which is 8 morning. Yeah, I didn't pay attention to the
New York time.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I finished my interview with you, I went down. My father and mother, my brother Hamza and his children and his pregnant wife, my brother Muhammad and his wife, my sister Aya with her children who is now pregnant, my sister Saja and my sister Sundu. So about 25 people were in the house with me. So I went down and I found my father and my mother packing their bags. And when I talk about bags, I talk about children's school bags. We don't have suitcases, by the way, which is something that many people don't understand why. Because we don't have airports. We don't need suitcases. We travel with our backpacks. My children's kindergarten backpack, I stuffed it with some clothes. And I put some water bottle there. So I found my parents packing their bags. And I asked him, "Where are you going?" And they said, "You know, the Israelis just dropped some leaflets ordering the residents of Beit Lahi, about 90,000 people, you know, to evacuate." And that was the first time I found my parents, you know, leaving. And then I went upstairs. I didn't know what to take with me. I only took with me the only copy that I had of my first poetry book. And I took a bottle of water and some clothes for my children. And then we went to the refugee camp. And where do you know where we stayed? We stayed in the same neighborhood that was bombed yesterday, where 150 people were killed. And I just told you about the names of the people who were killed, including Mfathi, who I now remember that we got 1 hour of water from the tap when we were in the camp. And Mfathi would tell the neighbors, the water is on, fill your buckets. So I remember here. And then when the bombing got intense in the refugee camp, we thought of going to an UNRWA school, which is just a few hundred meters away from the neighborhood in the camp. So we stayed in a school shelter in Jabalia, which was later raided by the Israeli army. And by the way, a few days ago, the Israelis again visited that school, took the men out, and they have abducted so many, including my sister, my wife's sister husband. He's a brother-in-law to me. So they took him. And one reason he stayed in the school, he's a nurse. He couldn't leave the refugees in the school without any nursing person. So he was abducted and he's left with three children. The youngest was born after October 7th. So when the bombing got intense, I had to leave the school with my wife and kids, especially because we had the chance to leave Gaza for Egypt. And on the Salah al-Din Street, which was described by the Israelis as a safe passage, I was abducted by the Israeli soldiers. I was handcuffed and blindfolded. And before that, I had to remove all my clothes. I was naked for the first time in my life. And under gunpoint, two Israeli soldiers were pointing their guns at me and the person next to me. And then we were taken to a place we didn't know. I mean, it, for me, as a Palestinian who was born in Gaza, I had never been to Palestine, which is now Israel. So that was the first time for me to sleep in my country. As a detainee, as someone who was blindfolded and handcuffed, as someone who didn't know whether his wife and children, who he left behind, were still breathing. Just imagine, not only was I taken, and blindfolded and handcuffed and beaten and harassed, and insulted. They kept saying bad words in Arabic. These are the only words they know in Arabic, insulting words. But also I did not know whether my wife and kids, from whom I was separated, were still breathing, whether they went to a place that is safe, because there is no place that is safe. Why? Because when there is occupation, there is nothing that's called a safe place. And I had also to worry about my mother and father, who I left behind in the refugee camp, and my siblings and their children. I mean, I was torn. I was torn into 100 pieces, thinking about myself. Where, why are they taking me? Where are they taking me? And I heard the some young men screaming. You know, some of them were had to be separated from their pregnant wives. So after 3 days, I was released. I was dropped at the same checkpoint.
But there was international outcry over you having been taken.
As Mus'ab Abu Toha, not as a Palestinian. So I think many people cared about me because I am a friend and a writer. But they did not maybe consider maybe doing the same thing with other people. It's easy to get someone out than getting a whole population from under the military fist of the Israeli army. I mean, I just imagine if I was not a writer, if I was not a poet, if I did not have a publisher, if I did not have an some journalist and magazine that I wrote for. Just imagine, no one knew about me. I would still have been under the Israeli custody. Maybe I could have died, just like Dr. Adnan El-Borsh, who was taken from Al Auda Hospital, by the way, in November last year, and he was announced dead last October. He was the best surgeon in the Gaza Strip, and he died. He was killed.
The Palestinian poet Mus'ab Abu Toha. When we come back, we'll talk about his friend, the Palestinian poet Rifat Al-Arir. He was killed in a targeted Israeli airstrike last year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We return to our October interview with Palestinian poet Mus'ab Abu Toha, author of the new collection of poetry, Forest of Noise.
I wanted to ask you about another man, another poet, but he didn't make it. Yeah. The Palestinian poet, the Islamic University professor, someone you knew, Rifat Al-Arir, last on Democracy Now!, October 10th, 2023. Rifat was killed by an Israeli strike in December, along with his brother, sister, and four of his nieces. This is Scottish actor Brian Cox reciting Rifat Al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die, and then I want you to share your poem, a sort of segue to Rifat's, If I Must Die, a video that went viral.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
Scottish actor Brian Cox, you know, who played in Succession, reciting Rifat Al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die, in a video that went viral. And you can go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Rifat just before he was killed. In your book, Mus'ab Abu Toha, Forest of Noise, talk about Rifat and then your kind of rejoinder to this poem.
I knew Rifat as a professor at the Islamic University of Gaza. He did not teach me, but I would say that he taught me a lot. Because when I was in my second year, he was in Malaysia finishing his PhD. And when he returned, I was already finishing my courses. But he was someone who led me to the We Are Not Numbers project that he co-founded, which is a project that offer some mentorship for young writers. I was in the beginning of my writing career. So he introduced me to the group, and that is a picture that I took with the strawberries.
We're showing an image of Rafat holding strawberries.
Yeah, yeah. We picked that strawberry, that same strawberry together in Betlehem, in my father-in-law's farm, my father-in-law's farm. So yeah, I knew Rafat as a father. He was a wonderful father for his kids, and he was a lovely son of his parents. His parents still survive, I hope, in Gaza City. And he's also a professor of English literature. And we talk when we were talking about literature, he would talk about Arabic literature and also English literature. His favorite poet, I think, was John Donne. And in the Arabic language, he loved the classical Arabic poems like Al-Asha, like Imru al-Qais, like Ibn Halliza. He would recite some Arabic poems to me, and I was amazed, you know. Before Rafat was killed, he published his poem, If I Must Die, and he posted it on his Instagram. And I read that poem, and I was still in North Gaza. It was before I was abducted. And it was very heartbreaking for me. I mean, someone writing about his death and what he wishes his death to be like. And I couldn't but try and write my own If I Must Die. But I did not call it If I Must Die. I wrote If I'm Going to Die. But after he was killed, I retitled the poem, which is now called A Request. A Request After Rifat al-Arair. If I am going to die, let it be a clean death. No rubble over my corpse, no broken dishes or glasses, and not many cuts in my head or chest. Leave my ironed, untouched jackets and pants in the closet so I may wear some of them again at my funeral. Yeah.
Musab Abu Toha reading from his new second book of poetry, Forest of Noise. Just months after Rafat was killed, his eldest daughter, Shaima Rifat al-Arir, was also killed in an Israeli strike in Gaza, along with her husband and two-month-old son, Rafat's grandchild.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine, I mean, Rifat became a grandfather after he was killed. And I mean, something that breaks my heart, just as it must break everyone's heart, is that when someone is killed, they even don't know who was killed with them. They don't know. I mean, Rifat did not know that his daughter Shaima and her husband Abdurrahman Siam, I think his name, and his grandchild were killed after him. I mean, I don't know whether he knows about this. He's now feeling a lot of pain knowing about this. So it is a campaign of killing the father, the mother, the sister. I would call this not only a genocide. It is not only a genocide against a people, but it's also a genocide against families. Because when you look at the names of the people who are killed, you see the name of the father, the mother, the children, the grandchildren. It's not about killing five people from the street or five people in the mosque or the school. It's killing a whole family. When I tell you that I lost 31 members of my extended family, I talk about two first cousins with their husband and their children. I'm not talking about my cousin, no. Her husband, their children, the youngest two or four.
Musab, how did you choose the title, Forest of Noise?
In fact, the title is of the book is the title of one of the poems called Forest of Noise, in which I talk about the potholes from the bullets and from the bomb, I mean, also the bomb craters, that each bullet hole in our walls, in our hospitals, in our schools, is a forest of noise. It's full of screams of the people who did not survive. The screams of people, I mean, I just talked about my neighbor, Ammar Abu Layla, who was killed by a bombshell. And his son is still bleeding in the house because there is no hospital that can reach that area. So even the bomb crater that was created by the bomb that killed his father is now being filled with the screams of this boy. There is no way for him to survive this if he continues to bleed. So every bullet hole in our buildings, every bomb crater is a forest of noise. It has our history. That goes back to 70, or more than, it's not only 76 years ago. It goes back to more than 76 years. It's a forest of noise. I've been living in Gaza all my life, and the only sound I could hear is the drones buzzing sound. It doesn't mean that I could not hear the lapping of the waves, but I mean, every single moment there is the drones buzzing sound in the sky. There is the sound of the F-16 flying over us. There's one thing that many people don't know, which is I've never heard the sound of an airplane, a civilian airplane. I've never seen a civilian airplane in the sky over Gaza. So it is everything.
Why?
We don't have an airport in Gaza. We don't even receive visitors from abroad. So there is no need for any airports in Gaza. We are living in siege. We can't leave Gaza when we want. And we don't get visitors. And we don't see airplanes in the sky. Because Gaza is under siege. It's under occupation.
And that goes to your book, Forest of Noise, where half the poems are written before October 7th, 2023, and half are written after. Explain the before and share one of your poems with us from before.
I mean, life in Gaza after October 7th is not very, very different from the life before. But the difference is the intensity of the airstrikes, the coldness of the outside world, seeing us being burned in the fire and buried in the rubble, I mean, for months. I mean, the difference is that before October 7th, when there is an Israeli airstrike, I mean, ambulances would race to the scene. I mean, fire trucks, people would gather to rescue whoever could be still breathing under the rubble. So after October 7th, what happened is that ambulances get hit, fire trucks get hit, nurses and doctors get abducted from inside the hospitals and the clinics, to the extent that and fuel has been cut, water has been cut, electricity has been cut, to the extent that even and phone signal has been cut. So just imagine you are bombed in your house, and you had your phone. You are lucky enough to have some battery on your phone, and there is no phone signal even to call your relatives and tell the ambulance that you are breathing and you have some children about to die under the rubble. You don't have this chance of asking for help. This is what's been happening after October 7th. It's not very different. The only difference is that there is no fuel like before. There are no ambulances. There is no medical equipment like before, even though we had a big lack in so many things. And the difference is that we have been documenting this for a year nonstop. And I have one question. What has the Palestinian people in Gaza and also in the West Bank, what has the people in Palestine, what have they not done in order for the world to step in and stop all of this? We have written poetry. We have written essays. We have taken videos. We have created films. We have run from our schools to humanitarian areas, which also later get bombed. I mean, what is one thing? I would like to ask this question to the whole world. What is one thing that the Palestinians in Gaza did not do to survive? I mean, can someone blame us? When we leave our house for a school shelter, we get bombed in a shelter. When we leave the school shelter to another one, we get bombed there. When we go from north to south, we get bombed there. When we try to leave Gaza, we can't. I mean, I have a friend of mine who was hit by a piece of a shrapnel, and he sent me a video. I still have it. There was maybe you could fit your fist in his chest. I still have this video, and he couldn't leave Gaza. That was November last year. He couldn't leave Gaza because Israel controls who leaves Gaza, even through the Rafah border crossing. So it's not only about Egypt, you know, closing the border crossing. Israel has destroyed and occupied the Rafah border crossing since last May. So they control who gets in, who leaves, what kind of biscuit, what kind of water enters Gaza. And this is the case since before October 7th.
Can you share with us your poem, yeah, Thanks, and describe how you came to write it?
So I wrote the poem, Thanks, in May 2021, after an airstrike hit a house that just next to us. And my mother was making a cake, even though it was war. She was making cake, and when there was an airstrike, we thought it was a warning. So we left the house, we ran away, and the poem will tell you what happened. Thanks, on the eve of my 22nd birthday, after Yusuf Komuniaka. Thanks to my mother always, but especially when she called for me to join them at the table, just seconds before shrapnel cut through the window glass where I stood watching distant airstrikes. My mother's voice, the magnet of my life, swaying my head just in time. plumes of smoke choked the neighborhood. It was night, and when we ran into the street, Mother forgot the cake in the oven, the bomb smoke mixed with the burnt chocolate and strawberry. And thanks to the huge clock tower's bell, which saved my life, I was crossing the street and my head glued to my phone never heeded the honk of cars or the wheels of vans screeching onto the rough tarmac. The bell tolled for me. Sorry, death, but it was the eve of my 22nd birthday, and I had to be by the sea and listen to the lapping of waves, the sound I last heard before my birth.
Musab, can you look into this camera and share your message with the world, what you want the world to take away right now about what's happening in your home in Gaza?
I mean, if the world cannot really help us, I hope that they will not continue to support the oppressor. If you can't really stop this, why don't you just go away? I mean, I wish the world was ignoring us. No, they are not ignoring us. No, they are contributing to our suffering and the genocidal campaign that Israel has been launching not since last year, since 76 years. I mean, you just mentioned that. That Blinken says that in a few days, you know, the negotiations would start again. I mean, why don't you say the same things about sending the weapons to Israel? Why don't you, in a few days we will try and send the Israelis some new weapons? Why don't you take your time and think about what these weapons are going to do? Why does it take time to resume negotiations and force the Israelis to stop their killing of my people? Why does it take time? Why is it difficult to stop this, but it's easy to send more and more weapons? Just leave us alone.
Your choice of a last poem to share with our audience around the world. Would you like to share The Moon or Right or Left or Under the Rubble?
So this poem, Under the Rubble, was written after October 7th. Under the Rubble. She slept on her bed, never woke up again. Her bed has become her grave, a tomb beneath the ceiling of her room, the ceiling a cenotaph. No name, no year of birth, no year of death, no epitaph. Only blood and a smashed picture frame in ruin next to her. In Jabalia camp, a mother collects her daughter's flesh in a piggy bank, hoping to buy her a plot on a river in a faraway land. A group of mute people were talking sign. When a bomb fell, they fell silent. It rained again last night. The new plant locked for an umbrella in the garage. The bombing got intense, and our house looked for a shelter in the neighborhood. I leave the door to my room open so the words in my books, the titles and names of authors and publishers could flee when they hear the bombs. I became homeless once, but the rubble of my city covered the streets. They could not find a stretcher to carry your body. They put you on a wooden door they found under the rubble. Your neighbors, a moving wall. The scars on our children's faces will look for you. Our children's amputated legs will run after you. He left the house to buy some bread for his kids. News of his death made it home, but not the bread. No bread. Death sits to eat whoever remains of the kids. No need for a table. No need for bread. A father wakes up at night, sees the random colors on the walls drawn by his 4-year-old daughter. The colors are about 4 feet high. Next year they would be 5. But the painter has died in an airstrike. There are no colors anymore. There are no walls. I changed the order of my books on the shelves. 2 days later, the war broke out. Beware of changing the order of your books. What are you thinking? What thinking? What you? You? Is there still you? You there? Where should people go? Should they build a big ladder and go up? But heaven has been blocked by the drones and F-16s and the smoke of death. My son asks me whether, when we return to Gaza, I could get him a puppy. I say, I promise, if we can find any. I ask my son if he wishes to become a pilot when he grows up. He says he won't wish to drop bombs on people and houses. When we die, our souls leave our bodies, take with them everything they loved in our bedrooms, the perfume bottles, the makeup, the necklaces, and the pens. In Gaza, our bodies and rooms get crushed. Nothing remains for the soul. Even our souls, they get stuck under the rubble for weeks.
The Palestinian poet Mosab Abu Toha. His collection of poetry is Forest of Noise. He writes for The New Yorker magazine. He's written for The New York Times and more. When we come back, Namante Nenkimo, an indigenous leader from the Guarani Nation in the Amazon rainforest of Ecuador. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday special, we turn now to Namante Nenkimo, an indigenous leader from the Guarani Nation in the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador. Last year, she helped win passage of a referendum in Ecuador to block oil drilling in the Amazon rainforest's Yasuni Park. But now, Ecuador's president, Daniel Noboa, is pushing for oil drilling to continue, saying it's needed to help finance the government's war against drug cartels. Environmental activists and indigenous peoples fear their victory to keep the oil in the soil could be overturned. Namante Nenkimo co-founded Amazon Frontlines and the Cebo Alliance. In June, she wrote an article for The Guardian headlined, "Ecuador's president won't give up on oil drilling in the Amazon. We plan to stop him again." Namante also recently published a memoir titled We Will Be Jaguars, a memoir of my people. She came into our Democracy Now! Studio in September, along with her co-author and partner, Mitch Anderson, who's the founder and executive director of Amazon Frontlines. He's long worked with indigenous nations in the Amazon to defend their rights. I began by asking Namante Nenkimo to introduce herself and to talk about the indigenous nation she's from and the land where she lives, in the Amazon, in Ecuador.
Buenos días a todos, a todos. Mi nombre es Namante Nenkimo. Soy mujer Guarani.
Good morning to all of you. My name is Namante Nenkimo. I am a Guarani woman, leader, mother, who comes from the Guarani territory of Pastaza in Ecuador. All women, in general, Amazonian women, are at the front lines of defense, giving our lives, because we women are more considerate and we worry about our sons and daughters, so that our daughters can have their living space, water, land, knowledge, values, plants, animals, so that we can live well, freely, and with dignity. Now our territory is threatened every day. Why should we as women be threatened in our territory? That is why I wrote a book about my resistance, about my childhood, from a child's point of view. I grew up between two worlds. The missionaries came talking about saving souls, saying that our beliefs were bad.
misioneros venían hablando sobre salvar las almas. Nuestra creencia es malo. Los petroleros vinieron nuestro.
The oil men came to our territory flying in helicopters, promising development. They did a lot of damage. They destroyed our water. They contaminated our land. They contaminated our people as well by disconnecting us from our knowledge and values. And also, the governments and the big organizations come to offer to say that they're going to build national parks, and at the same time they make things worse and take away our territory.
Ellos empeoran y nos quitan nuestro territorio. Entonces nuestra lucha es muy importante.
The struggle that we have lived through is very important, so I would like to contextualize it. It is a long story to tell in detail, so for me it is very important. As my father says, daughter, the more the people of the world don't know the jungle well, the more they destroy it. So my story and our culture is oral. That is why I transformed this oral story with my husband, Mitch, into writing, so that the world can understand how we indigenous peoples are living, connected with Mother Nature, with much love and with much respect.
Indígena conectada con la madre naturaleza, con mucho amor, con mucho respeto. Entonces, esa historia es una resiliencia, es una resistencia.
So this is a story of resilience, of resistance, so that the people of the world can know the true story of the indigenous peoples, of all the indigenous peoples who are living a great, gigantic threat. Because this system from here reaches our territory day after day after day. So this message is very important. You can read the book, you can touch and open your hearts and make a real commitment to take action. What am I trying to say with this? The communities and the civil society here, you have to open your hearts and condemn that the companies do not continue to invest in what harms our territory, in what exterminates our territory, our knowledge, our culture. So from here, we have to begin to re-educate ourselves, not to consume what destroys our health, and to reconnect with Mother Nature, to reconnect spiritually, to love Mother Nature again, and to heal ourselves. That is what's important.
Nosotros mismos. Eso es la importancia.
I wanted to go back to what happened last year, Namonte, in Ecuador, in the rainforest. On August 20th, 2023, Ecuador voted to halt all future oil drilling in Yasuni National Park. Then Daniel Noboa won the presidency in October, about a year ago, exactly. You were one of the leaders of this fight to protect Yasuni. Describe the Yasuni National Park, the movement you led, and then Daniel Noboa's changing position.
Pues el Yasuní es territorio ancestral de Waurani y ese parte.
Well, the Yasuní is an ancestral Waurani territory and is one of the world's most biodiverse areas. It gives us oxygen to the planet. To achieve this, the indigenous peoples united with all the peoples and then with activists, filmmakers, students. We made the people of the cities, of all the civil society, understand the importance and also see that throughout the oil exploitation in the territory in Ecuador and all the country, there has been no development. There has been more corruption, more problems, more death. So it was very evident, and the societies realized that it was very important to protect, to conserve the territory for the future. So this was also the work that we campaigned for.
Era el trabajo también que hicimos campaña, encabecé también en las organizaciones Amazon Frontline y otras organizaciones.
I also headed Amazon Frontlines, and with other organizations, we made a film so that people could see the Yasuni rainforest and its importance not only for the Waurani people, but for all the peoples of the planet. Then we achieved this victory in the referendum in Ecuador. In the whole country, we convinced them, and they voted yes to life. That was a powerful sign that I felt, that the people in the cities opened their conscience and opened their hearts and saw what was important was life, so we won. But the president has not met the standards. He should already begin to close and dismantle. And we, the indigenous peoples, have had enough.
Let me interrupt for 1 minute. So you passed the law first, and this took enormous mobilizing of people across Ecuador. What was the position that Noboa as candidate took after this law was passed? Clearly so popular that in order for him to win the presidency, he had to support the bill. Is that right?
Yes. During the campaign, Noboa said that he was going to respect the Yasuni. But now that he has been elected, he is not respecting it. I would say the politicians, not only Noboa, from my experience, from what I have seen in the presidents, they take office, they make promises, beautiful words and campaigns. But when they are already elected, they do not act with courage and bravery and don't think of asserting the right of the indigenous peoples, the right to nature. Never. That is why the indigenous peoples are united, ready to confront them. Our territory is our home. It is a living space for the future and for the people of the planet. And our territory will not be for sale.
De venta.
So the way Noboa is framing it now is they need money to fight drug lords and drug trafficking in Ecuador. And the way to get that money is to bring in foreign companies and to extract more resources to save the country. Your response to that, Namonte?
Well, he talks about the economy, but one day the oil is going to run out. It is not going to be sustaining the future. President Noboa has to care. He has to think about the future. He has to give opportunities. He should be a more important leader in the world that can change and leave the oil in the ground and see the alternative. Not the mentality of consumerism, but another form of mentality. A change, to see what can be generated in the future, and to see that the indigenous peoples are respected, that Mother Nature is respected to stop climate change for the world. But many times the leaders never think that. They just want money now, and there is no solution. That is not the solution for future generations, because Noboa has a great opportunity, because he is a young president who could change the world.
You're here in the midst of a presidential election in the United States, perhaps the most important. You've got the main parties, the Democrats versus the Republicans. On the issue of immigration, they vie with each other, or you might almost say agree on many points, is shutting down the border to immigrants coming from Mexico and south from there, including Ecuador. Can you make a direct link between thousands of Ecuadorians and people overall in the Amazon fleeing their land, their countries, because of environmental destruction, because of poverty, because of violence?
I think that this has happened a lot in the last few years because the climate crisis in general in the world is very serious, and we must not let that happen. We have to awaken the conscience of the people of the city. Why are people not happy? People are fleeing their countries because it not only affects Ecuador, because this system of consumption here provokes armed conflicts. It provokes oil extraction because the wider world needs that to plunder. They need money. That is why we have to look, to balance, to reconnect, to feel again the peace that we want in the society. Because Mother Earth is suffering these phenomena that affects all of us, and people are not realizing it. The politicians with the great power they have are not realizing it, because they are disconnected. They are not connected with the Earth. They are not connected with their spirituality. They don't have love. They don't have love at all.
No tienen amor. No tienen para nada amor. Entonces eso, la gente, la sociedad, tenemos que juntar.
So people, society, we have to get together, promote, socialize, unite, so we can solve it. We are not going to wait for the government to make the decision in our home. We are not going to allow the government to govern our blood, our territory. So the responsibility is for all of us. That is what I'm trying to say. The responsibility is not for the indigenous peoples. Why do we have to live in our territory daily under threat, day after day? Because the system does not stop. This mentality does not change. This heart does not touch deeply. So the work is here, in the big cities. I try to say as an indigenous woman, I see that. As an indigenous woman, I am seeing that the problem is not in the indigenous territory. The problem is here, this system, and all of us have to stop the system. That is the message. As long as we do not know life, which is the most important thing, we are going to destroy it. Mother Earth is not waiting for us to save her. Mother Earth is waiting for us to respect her, to love her again, to heal her again. That is the society we have to heal.
Mitch Anderson, you have worked on this issue for years. In the early 2000s, you were with Amazon Watch. You've spent a lot of time since then, well over 15 years, in the Amazon. You, together with your partner, Namonte, have founded Amazon Frontlines. But as you come back up into the United States, to your home country, do you see any progress being made? And also, as a person who can see the Amazon from here, from where your family and community was to where you are living now, with your children, with your new community, what do you feel is the biggest misunderstanding we have of the Amazon?
Yeah, so I've been living in the Amazon with Namonte and her people for the last 15 years. Most of the oil that's produced in the Amazon destroys the rivers and the forest, and then is shipped up to California to be refined in California, and then is distributed to gas stations around the country and made into jet fuel. I don't think that people in the United States truly understand that and truly understand what Namonte is saying about our consumption patterns and our systemic addiction to oil and how it is devastating indigenous cultures, their life ways, and also their territories. You know, in the 1960s, American oil companies discovered oil in the Ecuadorian Amazon and the Peruvian Amazon, made deliberate decisions to dump barrels of oil into the rivers, millions of gallons of oil and wastewater in order to save money, and created this massive public health crisis. For the Ecuadorian government at the time, they thought that this was going to be their salvation. It was going to take them out of subdevelopment and poverty. But what it's created over the last 60 years is disparities economically, inequalities, corruption, massive environmental contamination, poverty. I think that, you know, what Namonte, her people, youth climate activists in Ecuador have done is they've shown the Ecuadorian people, they've told stories to the Ecuadorian people, they've helped wake up consciousness and say, look, 60, 70 years of oil development and look where we're at right now. We need to keep the oil in the ground. We need to protect the most biodiverse forests in the world. We need to wake up our imagination, think about economic alternatives, think about regeneration. And, you know, the win in the Yasuni, in the most biodiverse forest in the world, is that. It's this model of climate democracy that is an inspiration for the entire world. And, you know, at Amazon Frontlines with Namonte, we're a collective of Western activists and indigenous leaders that are looking to stop the oil industry, the mining industry, the loggers, not let them into the forest, create permanent protection zones, but also work with indigenous communities to get their land back. Because essentially, indigenous communities are the ancestral owners of nearly half the remaining standing forest in the Amazon. They are only 5% of the world's population, but protect 80% of the biodiversity on our planet. Indigenous peoples are the owners of 40% of the intact ecosystems worldwide. And so what we've seen here at Climate Week is civil society's waking up. Indigenous peoples are leading the marches. Indigenous peoples are sharing their stories, sharing their positions, amplifying their values. But what we're seeing is that politicians, world leaders, companies are still really committed to sucking the last drops of oil out of the forests, out of the oceans, and we can't afford that.
Namonte, take us on this profound journey you take us on in your book, We Will Be Jaguars. Tell us first about where you were born in Ecuador, in the Amazon, one of the last places contacted by missionaries. You've said the authors of our destruction are the very ones who preach our salvation. But start off by talking about your face and the images on your face that, for our radio audience, it is a hue of red across your eyes from temple to temple, and what that means, and also your headdress.
Pues yo, de niña, crecí de dos...
As a child, I grew up in two worlds, very pretty, beautiful. The feeling as a child of seeing the evangelicals flying around bringing us the word of Jesus, and also seeing our grandparents around us, healing us with plants. So I was a very curious girl. I wanted to discover. I wanted to understand who were these people, the white people, and the grandparents. Who are they? So I grew up in a very nice, very beautiful time, because in our territory we still lived collectively at that time. Our chakra, our river, our way of living was free in a big space. Our culture is the achote. On the forehead, we paint our eyes to protect from bad energy, and also beauty for the women, who can paint that part of the face and show the identity of our origin as Warani women.
Corona significa este es ave guacamayo. Para nosotros este ave muy sagrado.
The crown is from the feathers of the macaw bird, and for us the bird is very sacred. And they were very valuable for our ancestors, and we still believe that. Macaws fly, they sit in a tree and start to communicate amongst themselves, and then they plan where they're going to fly to look for food. So when you wear the crown, it represents a woman leader, and that you're united with your family to protect your home and your communities. And the necklace means that you are a leader. It represents power, the power of women. That's our culture. The seed is called pentomo. There are many of these plants in the jungle, and for us, it protects us from bad energy and also gives us good vibes, good energy. And when you go to a ceremony and when you go to meetings, you wear this. So in our culture, it's like 50 or 60 years since we've had contact with the world, with the outside world. And of course, there is a new generation. And we think about how to describe our knowledge, and our grandparents are already dying. So we have to teach our own culture to the young people, to young leaders, so that they continue to protect their territory and having their own language. And so it's very important for us to go back to have our own education system, our own traditional education, and at the same time, learn about the outside education system and learn about how to use this knowledge to protect our territory so there's still forests. And if the forest is healthy, we're going to be healthy. But if the forest is sick and is contaminated, then we're going to start to get sick, and we are going to disconnect ourselves from our knowledge, our language, and we are going to lose everything, as has happened to other peoples who have been disappearing for 500 years. And we do not want our territory and our life to disappear. We want to continue being Warani with a knowledge of two worlds, valuing our principles.
Namante Nenkimo, an indigenous leader from the Huarani Nation in the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador. Her new book is titled We Will Be Jaguars, A Memoir of My People. She wrote it with her partner, Mitch Anderson. Together, they founded the group Amazon Frontlines. And that does it for this holiday special. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alko.
Hi, this is John Wiener, host of Living in the USA, with the news that we're moving our show from Thursdays at 3 p.m.